roots of poverty and the roots of climate change are the same. It is this this logic of domination and endless greed that that has created a broken economy and that is breaking the planet. And that the way out of the crisis, of both crises, is the same. It is another economic model that lives within nature's limits.
Nathan Schneider, we give you the last word.
The Pope is calling here for us to change how we live, how we what we do with our resources. You know, this is not just moving from one kind of consumerism to another. This is a kind of spiritual renewal and also a material renewal that allow that in which we turn ourselves toward an economy that's sustainable, that's life-giving both for humanity and the rest of the world.
Nathan Schneider of the Catholic magazine America and Naomi Klein, author of This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. Thanks so much for joining us. That does it for our show. We have job openings. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. It's time for the evening news.
Kick me one of them funky-ass beats.
Tune in Thursday, June 18th at 10 p.m. for a special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. We'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival with interviews, music, and interactions with the producers and participants, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive, entertaining, and intimate festival. Again, be sure to tune in at 10 p.m. Thursday, June 18th for our What the Festival broadcast here on KBOO Community Radio. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor for ALEC Expo's film screening and workshop on June 18th, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. ALEC, the American Legislators Exchange Council, is a corporate-directed organization which writes model legislation for state legislatures around the nation that is beneficial to multinational corporations. Secretive corporate-directed and funded organizations like ALEC undermine the principles of citizens participating in democratic processes. ALEC Expose explains how ALEC functions, who is involved, and how to fight back to promote democratic, non-corporate values. Again, that's ALEC Expose, June 18th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the home page under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News... A suspect has been caught in the shooting deaths of 9 African Americans at a Charleston, South Carolina church last night.
A new UN report reveals that nearly 60 million people around the globe have been forcibly displaced by war and persecution.
And the U.S. House votes today approving fast-track authority moves the Trans-Pacific Partnership closer to approval.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 18th, 2015. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Sari Gametha. A 21-year-old white supremacist shot and killed 9 black worshipers in a church prayer meeting in Charleston, South Carolina last night. The victims of the horrific hate crime have been identified as Sharonda Coleman Singleton, 45, Reverend Clementa Pinckney, 41, Cynthia Hurd, 54, Tywanza Sanders, 26, Myra Thompson, 59, Ethel Lance, 70, Daniel Simmons, 74, Reverend DePayne Middleton, 49, and Susie Jackson, 87. 3 other people who were present at the prayer meeting managed to survive. One was a 5-year-old child, survived by playing dead on the floor in a pool of blood. The man who carried out the massacre, Dylan Roof, was known amongst his classmates in high school as supporting segregation and telling people he wanted to start a civil war. During the shooting, Roof allegedly told his victims that he, quote, had to kill them because they were, quote, raping our women and taking over our country. After the shooting, the city of Charleston was not put in lockdown, but many black residents reported that they were afraid to leave their homes while the killer was at large. Police released the identity of the suspect early Friday morning, along with a description of his car. At around 10:30 this morning, a florist in North Carolina called in a tip that she saw what looked like Roof's car. After following the car for several miles to be sure, she called the police. They pulled him over after a few minutes and took him into custody without incident. In Portland this evening, local pastor Dr. T. Allen Bethel, along with the Albina Ministerial Alliance, are holding a vigil tonight in honor of the deceased. The vigil will be at 6 tonight at the Bethel AME Church, 3 blocks south of Ainsworth on Northeast 8th Avenue. Stay tuned at 5:45 after this newscast for responses and analysis of last night's racist massacre in South Carolina.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that the state of Texas has the right to reject a license plate design containing the Confederate flag. The Texas chapter of a group called Sons of Confederate Veterans proposed a specialty license plate design using their logo, which includes the Confederate flag, in 2009. The Texas Department of Motor Vehicles Board rejected the design after taking public comments. The board determined that many members of the public found the design offensive and associated the Confederate flag with hate. The group sued the state and federal district court and lost, but the decision was overturned on appeal. The state appealed to the Supreme Court in 2014, and in a 5-4 ruling, the Supremes sided with Texas. The majority decision was written by Justice Breyer, who was joined by Justices Thomas, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. The court held that because Texas's specialty license plate designs constitute government speech, it was entitled to reject a proposal for plates featuring a Confederate battle flag. 9 other U.S. states currently allow the Confederate flag to appear on license plates.
Israeli extremists last night burned the church where Jesus is believed to have multiplied loaves and fishes. In addition to setting the church on fire, the arsonists wrote graffiti in Hebrew on the walls that read, "False idols will be smashed," and also, "Pagans." The church is located along the Sea of Galilee and is run by the Catholic Benedictine Order, is best known for its 5th century mosaics, including one depicting 2 fish flanking a basket of loaves. Christian churches have been targeted by right-wing Jewish Israeli attacks hundreds of times in recent years. In May of 2014, the Romanian Orthodox Church in Jerusalem was defaced in a suspected hate attack. The attacker spray-painted the words "price tag," "Jesus is garbage," and "King David for the Jews." 2 weeks earlier, ahead of a visit to the country by Pope Francis, suspected Jewish extremists sprayed hate graffiti on Vatican-owned offices in Jerusalem. The Hebrew language graffiti read, "Death to Arabs and Christians and those who hate Israel." The Church of the Multiplication is believed by Christians to be the site of Jesus' miracle of multiplying 2 fish and 5 loaves to feed 5,000 people. The head of the National Christian Assembly in Palestine issued a statement that the attack on the church represents a practical application of the stances taken by the Israeli government, which funds fanatic groups. Israeli authorities say that they are investigating to see if the fire was an accident or was intentional, but Christians who live in the area say that it was obviously intentional, and the Israeli police are not taking the investigation seriously. No arrests have been made in connection with the burning of the loaves and fishes church last night.
Israel's legislative body, the Knesset, renewed a controversial marriage law today. The law bans Palestinians married to Israelis from moving to Israel or becoming Israeli citizens. Because military law forbids Israelis from entering Israeli-occupied territories, Israeli-Palestinian mixed couples are effectively denied married life together. The Knesset passed the law in 2003 as a year-long security measure in hopes that it would prevent Palestinian terrorists from entering Israel by marrying Israelis. It has been renewed by Knesset vote every year since then. In 2003, the vote passed by a thin margin, but it was renewed today by a vote of 57-20. However, the vote today has also changed the way the law will be renewed in the future.
Police across Oregon are going to get body cameras, a move that is supported by state civil rights advocates. They're also getting new stun guns, a move which doesn't have quite as much support from the community. Oregon lawmakers passed a bill with overwhelming support that would make police body cameras legal. The bill includes strict restrictions on the availability of the footage, and released footage will blur the faces of people beyond recognition in the videos. The Portland Police Bureau plans to install the body cameras later this year. Portland police will also get an update to stun guns used by police. The update comes after the U.S. Department of Justice ruled that Portland police engage in excessive and unjustified use of tasers against people suffering from mental illness. The newer model of the tasers proposed capture more information, including the amount of electricity used and how well the stun gun performs. The new tasers will cost the department $1.8 million. It is unclear how updating the stun guns used by police would solve the problems of misuse.
Truck traffic on Portland's highways has increased dramatically in recent months. In an interview with a reporter from Oregon Live, the Port of Portland attributed this rise in truck traffic to the loss of business in the port's Terminal 6. Labor relations at Terminal 6 have been strained for years since the Port of Portland turned management over to ICTSI, a private terminal management company based in the Philippines. To make matters worse, earlier this year, shipping companies Hanjin and Hapag-Lloyd stopped using Portland as a port of call. That meant an end to almost 80% of the terminal's business. Now, goods which would otherwise have been loaded directly onto boats for international shipping have to be taken to ports in Tacoma or Seattle. Since rail carriers in the Northwest are operating too near to capacity to accommodate that many of Portland's export goods, the trucking industry has been picking up the slack. This has meant more congestion on I-5 and on the interstate bridge, and a slower commute for Portland workers living in Washington.
Intel Corporation is in the process of laying off employees due to a reduced sales outlook for the coming year. But the layoffs do not jeopardize their massive tax exemptions given to them by Washington County last summer. The tax exemption is among the biggest in the nation and has no requirement for Intel to employ a certain number of Oregonians. Brian Krasanich, CEO of Intel, said in a memo that no more than a few hundred employees will lose their jobs and it will not have a significant effect on the Oregon economy. KBOO News reporter Catherine Maticek spoke with Jim Hauser, co-chair of Main Street Alliance in Oregon, and a small business owner about Intel's tax breaks and recent layoffs.
I am speaking with Jim Hauser, the co-chair of the Oregon branch of Main Street Alliance and owner of Hawthorne Auto Clinic. Recently, Washington County approved property tax breaks for Intel to last 3 decades. This is Intel's 5th major tax exemption since coming to Oregon, and they have saved Intel almost $123 million in the last year alone. As a small business owner, what would it mean for a company to have its property taxes not increase from year to year?
It is so, so disheartening. All of these tax breaks, tax credits, tax giveaways that deplete the money that the state of Oregon has to conduct all of its business, to keep our standard of living high. Every time that money is given away, then the burden, the responsibility for the taxes gets shifted onto smaller businesses and onto middle class. Now, the reason, supposedly, the justification for these big tax breaks is supposed to be the jobs that are going to be created. It's just so disheartening to see that it continues to be relied on, this let's give them big tax breaks and hope that they do the right thing. And you would think by now people would have learned that's not going to happen. All those folks who are going to get laid off are people who have mortgages, who buy groceries, who buy tires, who are an essential part of any healthy community, and that's all going away. I just don't understand it.
Intel has announced that they're going to lay off upwards of 100 200, 300 employees in Oregon, and this does not jeopardize their tax exemptions with the state of Oregon.
what we continue to do is only give up the, in this case, the tax breaks from our side without requiring any confirmation, any responsibility from the other side to carry through from their side. This hasn't worked before. Why should it work now? Where's your evidence this is going to work to give these big tax credits, tax breaks, without any responsibility to follow through?
So people say that the Oregon legislature offers Intel these tax exemptions to keep them here and that we can't afford to lose big companies like Intel that invest jobs in Oregon and billions of dollars into the economy. What would you say to those people?
Well, I think it's wonderful when they're creating jobs. I just think they need to accept responsibility for commitments that they make. When we make a commitment to them, they need to take responsibility for their part of the commitment. Otherwise, we're just being foolish. That money that we gave them in the way of tax credits, we could be giving to small businesses who are creating jobs. There are far more jobs being created by small businesses in aggregate than Intel, when Intel is cutting. If the company does not make the investment that they promised to make, if they don't provide the jobs they say they're going to provide, if they turn around and cut jobs, then they lose the tax break and they pay it back.
Thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today, Jim.
Thank you for inviting me, Catherine.
That was Jim Hauser from Main Street Alliance talking about Intel's recent layoffs. This is Catherine Matichek with KBOO News.
The House of Representatives approved promotional trade authority for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But the bill has to go to the Senate because it represents just one-third of the legislative package they drafted weeks ago. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Patty Lavera, the associate director at Food and Water Watch. She explained their concerns over the fast-tracking of the TPP.
The House of Representatives has gone ahead and approved a fragmented version of trade promotional authority for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it's been characterized as a punt because the bill now gets reworked in the Senate. Can you talk about the number of paths this legislative package can take from here?
Folks who've been following this issue remember that last Friday, it was the House's turn to pass the fast-track proposal. The Senate passed it a few weeks ago. They had more trouble in the House getting the math to work, like getting the vote. They broke it into three parts, and they weren't able to pass each part. They weren't able to pass especially a piece setting up assistance for workers who might be impacted by new trade deals. And the reason that that mattered is the House had to pass it exactly like the Senate passed it, or they don't have the same bill. So today they tried again, and in the House they just passed one part of the overall thing that the Senate passed. They just passed the part that's actually trade promotion authority, which is that fast-track mechanism. Now that's got to go back to the Senate, and the Senate needs to pass the same thing that the House passed, so they have a finished bill. And so that's where we are. It's not clear yet when the Senate's going to do that. This whole thing has been a spectacle. This is not about folks representing their actual constituents. The folks that voted in any form for Fast Track are letting down their constituents, and their constituents need to remember that. It's absolutely a display of what's wrong with Congress when we see these kinds of procedures go through. And it is notable. I mean, the only way they get these trade deals approved is by limiting Congress's authority, like taking themselves out of what their responsibility is, which is to evaluate and debate and consider bills. The only way they can pass these trade deals is if Congress ties its own hands and doesn't do its normal job of considering a bill.
Actually, I have a very detailed question about just that, but I want to get to your organization's interest in this legislative package before we go there. Are you feeling more concerned for the impact it's bound to have on agricultural policy, or would you contend it poses a greater threat as it applies to the nation's waterways?
We're really concerned about both. There's a couple specific reasons for each issue. We're worried about increasing food imports from countries that don't have the standards that we have for anything, environmental or worker or safety standards, worried about imported food for our water supply. There's a lot of private water companies that are European. We're negotiating a trade deal with the European Union. It doesn't get as much play as the TPP, but there's still that. A lot of private water companies are European and would love to have more access to U.S. municipal water systems, and we're afraid the trade deals could facilitate that. We're concerned about the countries in negotiating both these trade deals are big markets for natural gas, so we're concerned about more fracking happening in the United States, which hurts our water, hurts our communities, so that you can send more gas exported to these countries. And for both issues, these trade deals are about dumbing down and deregulating and taking away U.S. standards to facilitate trade. We need safety standards for both our food and our water. These deals are about allowing corporations a venue to attack domestic standards, and that cuts across all kinds of issues. And that's actually the overarching worry we have about these style of trade deals.
Under the assigning of governmental tasks listed in Article 1 of the United States Constitution, Section 8, among the powers bestowed upon the legislative branch include commerce with foreign nations. Can this vote be interpreted as an abdication of their duties as federally elected officials?
Well, we think that it does. I mean, we think this is Congress tying in their own hands, the folks that voted for this. They're limiting their own authority to weigh in on issues that are incredibly important to our economy. And if you have to do that, if that's what it takes to get one of these new trade deals through, then that should cause us a lot of pause about what's in these trade deals. If the only way to get them through is to take away one branch of government and take them out of the equation, that they can't have any involvement, then that should really be enough reason not to do these trade deals, if they can't take the light of day and a little bit of transparency and some debate from our elected officials, then this is not a process worth doing. So we absolutely agree this is a complete abuse of the process that we're supposed to use to make our laws. I don't know if you're going to tell people how your local area folks voted, but I looked it up if you want to know. Representative DeFazio did the right thing, voted no. He's been real strong against this for a long time. He's been a leader, actually, against Fast Track, so people should thank him. But everybody else, Bonamici, Blumenauer, Schrader, and Walden, did vote for it. So, you know, they're headed home to spend time in the district, so people need to remind them what the right vote was and what the wrong vote was.
I've been talking with Patty Lavera. She is an associate director with the food team at Food and Water Watch. For more information, you can visit their website at foodandwaterwatch.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Congress begins its recess this week, and none of the Oregon senators or representatives have any public town halls or appearances scheduled. They will return to Congress on July 6th, and the fast-track vote will likely be at the top of the Senate's agenda.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the response to the Charleston massacre, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, a discussion with Ruby Lewis, the creator of Please Don't Die, Black Men. Tomorrow's weather is mostly sunny with a high of 75 and a low of 52. And today in history, the War of 1812 began. In 1984, liberal radio host Peter Berg was gunned down for his beliefs in Denver, Colorado. In 1798, President John Adams signed the Alien and Sedition Acts into law. And in 1815, Napoleon was defeated at the Battle of Waterloo. The quote of the day is from bell hooks: "All our silences in the face of racist assault are acts of complicity."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
When the rest of the country was going red, we were still going blue. And a lot of that was a lot of the coalition partners in our community groups and labor organizations going on offense rather than on defense.
Working Families Party of Oregon co-chair and UFCW Local 555 Secretary Treasurer Jeff Anderson. New Oregon state laws guaranteeing paid sick leave and creating a new state-sponsored retirement savings system are recent legislative wins in which the Working Families Party of Oregon played a key role. Governor Kate Brown is expected to sign both measures into law soon. Anderson says those small small, the Working Families Party is demonstrating it can also be powerful.
We think the Working Families Party is kind of an integral part of this. It is a coalition of a lot of private sector unions and various communities of color, social economic justice groups. We are trying to build a different view of what a society should be. Without the Working Families Party, we would not have canvassed 40,000 homes in Portland, 8,000 homes in Eugene. The Working Families Party is the little engine that could.
The sick leave bill provides 40 hours per year paid sick leave. The retirement security bill requires businesses to offer a voluntary state retirement savings plan to workers. It does not require businesses to contribute money to those plans. The California Labor Commission has ruled that Uber drivers are employees. The ruling means Uber and similar services that use apps to provide rides to people will have to meet the legal responsibilities of having employees rather than just freelance contractors doing the driving. The National Taxi Workers Alliance and the San Francisco Taxi Workers Alliance welcomed the ruling. They say it means that Uber drivers are entitled to employee protections under the law. And they say it could have, quote, a game-changing impact on a company that profiteers from breaking laws and cutting costs, end quote. The Taxi Workers Alliance plans organizing actions in a protest at Uber headquarters in San Francisco during the National Mayor's Conference on June 22nd.
I'm so pumped up. I know that we're going to win, and we're not going to stop fighting until we win.
Workers Independent News wants to improve and increase our coverage of the low-wage worker movement. We have a campaign right now on Indiegogo.com to do just that. For more information, go to Indiegogo and search for Raise the Wage, or go to laborradio.org and look for information there about the campaign.
On a burger, on a fries, make our wages super size. 15 of the union! 15 of the union!
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Oregon's law allowing legal adult use of marijuana goes into partial effect on July 1st. The question is, how will adults legally gain access to the marijuana that they will be allowed to grow and possess? The State House Senate Committee on Implementation of Measure 91 heard testimony earlier today from advocates and dispensary owners who are seeking an early start to adult use sales. Here's some audio from today's hearing. The first speaker is consultant and lobbyist Sam Chapman, the second businessman and trade association representative Don Morse.
The main issue that I have in terms of the Cannabis Genetics Preservation Society is that of seeds, and that seeds have kind of been, to my delight, a non-controversial issue, as I expect they will continue to be non-controversial. But I had noticed that in all of the early sales language across the board, seeds were not included. I suspect that was something that was just overlooked. Again, because they haven't been controversial, there hasn't been a whole lot of talk about seeds specifically outside of breeder conversations. And so I just wanted to put it before the committee that I'd heavily encourage you, if we do go forward with recreational sales, early recreational sales, that we include seeds. I really don't see a reason not to. They're not going to need the same type of due diligence periods that maybe edibles and extracts are going to require because of labeling and packaging. Okay. So I'd very heavily encourage you to add seeds. The second point being that Oregon has a very vast amount of rare genetics here in the state, and I've heard a lot of talk about, you know, the future expectation of being able to eventually export the best quality products of Oregon elsewhere. And I think that the best way that you can preserve these genetics is not by cloning and continuing to clone. Eventually, you break down the genetics of a plant when you continue to clone it. But from a seed, you have real genetics that can last longer in time in general. And so that's something that's very important that I want to put forth. The other issue that I just wanted to raise was just my support for early recreational sales in general. I think you're going to hear a lot of people talk about how, and there may be agreement already here in the committee, that, you know, in order to really avoid any black eyes in terms of, you know, say it being legal to possess and grow, but we have nowhere to buy it, you know, we'll hear a lot about, you know, this is going to help us be in line with the Cole memo. I agree with that. I think the more important local point that may resonate with this committee is that if we truly want to keep this industry a craft industry and we want to empower the mom and pop small businesses to be able to survive in this industry, we need to have early recreational sales. I can tell you right now, as a consultant in the industry that works with dispensaries, existing dispensaries and new dispensaries, that they're hurting right now. If you're one of the 130 some odd dispensaries in Portland, you are struggling to stay open if you're not one of the top 5% of dispensaries that have the capital to do marketing, the resources for all of these products that people need, you know, the staffing, just the overhead in general. A lot of these businesses are starting to drown and either sell out to larger big business that is not local, and that can, unfortunately, in some instances, circumvent residency laws, that we need to give local residents and existing businesses as much of a leg up on the existing and future competition that we will see in the state of Oregon. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
For the record, my name is Donald Morris, and I'm here representing the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. Mm-hmm. I, too, would like to offer my support for early sales. On Tuesday, we held a meeting of all of our dispensary members, and overwhelmingly, they supported the early start. The main reason that we discussed is that we feel that medical dispensaries are going to be put in a precarious position. We anticipate that the number of medical patients who will come in and get marijuana that they will then turn around and sell to their friends, basically, is going to be huge. That by not starting soon with under 91 and making marijuana available to those who want it retail, we're putting those people in a precarious position. Do they go to the park and get it, or do they find a friend who has a card and, you know, OLCC calls it shoulder tapping or whatever? But however, that medicine is going to get to these people one way or another. And rather than putting them in a position where they may be breaking the law, I think it's in the best interest of everyone that we give them a means to obtain the marijuana as soon as possible. We do have a few concerns about, you know, the July 1 date. That's only a few weeks away. To ramp that up is going to take a lot of effort on a lot of people's parts. We realize that. But at any rate, the sooner we can do this, the better.
That was a portion of today's hearing of the Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91. Marijuana becomes legal in Oregon for people over 21 on July 1st.
Oregon legislators are considering a bill that would help provide health care to people who have been denied access to federal assistance. Palau, the Marshall Islands, and the Federated States of Micronesia are part of an agreement with the U.S. called the Compact of Free Association States, or COFA. The U.S. military tested nuclear weapons in these territories for decades following World War II. People from COFA nations can come to the U.S. without a visa, but legal residents who come from these nations are banned from Medicaid. Oregon is considering a bill that might help close that gap. David Anatok is the president of the Oregon Marshallese community. He spoke at a public hearing in Salem on Monday.
With the testing of the nuclear testing of Marshall Islands and in the Pacific Islands, we have the highest rates in the chronic diseases. A lot of the folks today, especially the adults, those ones that we're targeting on this bill, under 133% of the FPL, either go to free clinics or wait till they go to the emergency room, which is their only access to healthcare at this point. So this bill is very dear and near to our heart, as some of the words from the ministers mentioned, personal experiences and stories that we live and people that are dying every day that we see go to their funerals. As a matter of fact, just yesterday, we had a friend of ours that was very close to us, went to his funeral services. He was from Ponape and had three daughters and two grandchildren. And he left them at a very young age. But yeah, this would be just part of what Oregon can do to make us feel more free as it says on the freely associated states or Compact of Free Association. That being said, I now remember it. Of course, the first bill Oregon State carried was the driver license bill, helped restore it to the 8 years, which was the first step towards making us more free, and especially being an Oregon resident.
Since the bill was drafted, changes have been made that could mean more tangible results. To learn more, KBOO reporter Alan Montecelio talked to Joe Enlett from the COFA Alliance National Network.
So yes, this bill is now a little bit more tangible in the sense of we are calling for immediate action to help cover the COFA Islanders rather than asking them to do an assessment or an analysis. In terms of the concept of the bill and the reasoning and the rationale that we have and the argument that we're putting forth, there really is no argument against it. I have not heard any kind of opposition against it. And we are getting bipartisan support. Actually, one of our champions is a Republican. At the Ways and Means Committee, what they're debating over right now is actually the budget, because, as you know, it's a very tight budget this session. There's not a lot of money. So that's the only setback that we have right now. But we also have come up with an innovative program idea that will actually generate revenue for the state. One example said that if we were to cover 1,000 COFA Islanders for 21 months, which is the 5 months plus, you know, the entire biennium, for 21 months to cover 1,000 COFA Islanders, the state would have to pay or fund $395,000. Approximately. But what the federal government money amount would be that's going to be coming in the form of tax credits, it's actually $5 million.
Supporters hope to pass this version of the bill before the legislative session ends.
Last week, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency released a 1,000-page document entitled Hydraulic Fracturing Drinking Water Assessment. The massive document reports on the effect of fracking for the safety of drinking water. Its conclusions were not surprising. The report says that fracking has an unknown consequence on drinking water. The EPA could only assess less than half of the over 1,000 chemicals used in the fracking process, according to EcoWatch. According to the EPA, from 2000 to 2013, over 9 million people lived within 1 mile of a hydraulically fractured well. The report also dedicates hundreds of pages to the potential and largely unassessed dangers of fracking. The whole report relies on, quote, available data and literature, and offers no new research on the effects of fracking on drinking water.
In the UK, Greenpeace won an appeal to publish a previously redacted document on the impacts of fracking on housing prices. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs is now forced to release the entire document, as Greenpeace argued redacting evidence is misleading to the public. The UK government claims there is no effect on housing prices, as opponents claim fracking could shed thousands of pounds off of housing values. Scotland and Wales both seem to be moving away from fracking, while David Cameron, Prime Minister of the UK, has said the government is, quote, going all out for fracking.
The stalemate between Greece and its creditors continue with no sign of either side willing to compromise. Greece owes $1.8 billion in loan payments due on June 30th. If a deal is not made by then, Greece will default and risk economic collapse, an exit from the EU, and leaving the euro. The Greek population is getting increasingly nervous about the future of their economy and their money. If the major banks pull out of Greece, there would be a major shortage of euros and could prompt a run on the banks. A bank run could push the Greek government to print its own money, leaving the euro and returning to the old Greek currency, the drachma. The Greek economy has shrunk by a quarter since 2010 and currently has an unemployment rate of 26%. Bailout funds are available to Greece from the European Central Bank, but it requires Greece to implement austerity measures. The ECB has 7.2 billion euros available to help bolster the Greek economy, but the recently elected Greek government ran on a planned form of anti-austerity and seems unlikely to agree to the conditions of the bailout funds. The debate will continue between Greece and its creditors until the June 30th deadline. Hopefully, a compromise can be made that keeps the welfare of the Greek people at its center.
Hong Kong's legislature voted down China's plan to control elections for the city's top political office. The proposal fell short of the two-thirds majority it needed to pass. Beijing's plan helped spark protests in Hong Kong last year. The proposal would allow free elections for the city's chief executive, but only after approving the candidates through a nominating committee. But pan-democrats want an election where anybody can run for the position. Chinese authorities have expressed their disappointment, but insist that it is the only option on the table.
The number of forcibly displaced people around the world reached nearly 60 million at the end of 2014. That's according to a report released this morning by the United Nations in advance of World Refugee Day, which is Saturday, June 20th. The report, titled Global Trends Report, World at War, notes that a decade ago, some 37.5 million people had been forcibly displaced as a result of war, conflict, and persecution. That number rose to just over 51 million at the end of 2013 and leapt to nearly 60 million at the end of last year. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Antonio Guterres warns that UN agencies, NGOs, the Red Cross, we no longer have the capacities and the resources to respond to such a dramatic increase in humanitarian needs.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, Afghan officials say that at least 11 members of the security forces have been killed in a Taliban assault on government buildings in southern Helmand province. The officials said today that four soldiers and seven police officers were killed when the Taliban fighters overran Musakala, a town which has shifted between government and Taliban control for years. Local officials of eastern Nangarhar province said that hundreds of families have been displaced in the province following clashes between Taliban and Daesh fighters. Daesh is the Arabic acronym for the group calling itself the, quote, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The actions and beliefs of Daesh are harshly condemned by Muslims around the world. Earlier this week, unidentified gunmen shot dead a senior Afghan Taliban leader in Peshawar, Pakistan. Malvi Golhashmi, the shadow governor for Afghanistan's Nangarhar province, was critically injured in Peshawar on Sunday and succumbed to his injuries the following day.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ryan Strayer, Catherine Maticek, Doug McVeigh, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Alan Montesilio. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Sarika Mehta.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn host Positively Revolting Talk Radio, a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on the Radio Zine, host Ethan Scarl speaks with Dr. Jonathan Simon, author of Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century. They will talk about election theft in America and what we can do to stop it. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now stay tuned for a live... Now stay tuned for a live interview conducted by KBOO reporters.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. As many of you may not have known, I am in Nashville, Tennessee, having a few days with my family, with my daughter. She was speaking at a conference on race and diversity in science. And, of course, woke this morning, along with the rest of the country, to the horrible news about what happened in South Carolina, in Charleston. For those of you who are just joining us, according to AP and other reports, a white man opened fire during a prayer meeting inside a historic black church in downtown Charleston, South Carolina, killing 9 people, including the pastor. The pastor was also a state senator. The shooter is still... This is of great concern. Of course, the victims, 6 were women, 3 were men. Now, according to reports, the shooter actually went in and joined the prayer meeting and was there for about an hour praying with people inside the church. Of course, he was welcomed as a young white man going into an historic black church. And then he opened fire. It's being declared a hate crime by all involved. The victims were shot because they were black. And many of us never thought that we would be seeing this kind of activity happening again. We, all, of course, all